The following is a special presentation of Tony Curry Radio with Dr. Alex Hubline and Dr. Josh Claypo. This is Adapt or Perish.
Welcome to Adapt or Perish, along with Dr. Alex Hubline, president of Adaptogen. I am Dr. Josh Claypo. Alex, how are you?
And I'm doing great. Doing great. How about you?
I'm doing good. Well, let's just say I've had a busy meeting. I've had a busy morning. I'm sorry, not a busy meeting. As you and I were talking about, every once in a while when you're a clinical psychologist, even if you're not doing clinical psychology, you find yourself doing clinical psychology. So, but all of that is good. It's all good. You are back from Dallas, right? That's where you were?
I was. I spent all of last week in Dallas at a trade show.
Well, that's not, but you, it wasn't just a trade show. You were changing the world at this trade show. So you know that I love, and there will be no Styx references in this segment, but you know that I love to find the music. I think that's my favorite part of doing our show is, yes, we're talking business strategy. Yes, you have the insights, but I actually like finding the lyrics and the songs. No, I couldn't find any classic. Well, I found classic rock, but I sent you those ones that are cheesy, Journey and Bon Jovi. But I know. In fact, I actually felt bad sending you. But listen, this is, I sent you the one from Eminem. I am an Eminem fan. And I love this lyric. I'm not going to sing it. I'm not going to rap it. But it is, he says, look, if you had one shot or one opportunity to seize everything you ever wanted in one moment, would you capture it? Or just let it slip. And I just thought, like, man, for what you're going to talk about, this, you know, this is very appropriate. So tell us about this unveiling. And then obviously we have some more secrets to get into and some insights, but I want to hear about the new product from Adaptogen.
Yeah, well, so it was fun. We launched a new product Tuesday of last week. So it's been less than a week now, but launched a new product at the trade show. And, you know, it was cool because it was the first new product we've come out with in a long while. And when I took over as president of the company, you know, one of the big initiatives that I wanted to see us take on was, you know, can we get some new products in the market? We're doing pretty well with the products that we had. But, you know, you kind of look at the market and you look at sort of how are you going to compete in the market? How are you going to drive some competitive differentiation? And I wanted to make sure that we were innovating. So we launched a new product. It's interesting. I'll give you a quick overview of it, but I won't go into all the gobbledygook and technical details. But basically, the idea is that our main software that we sell really goes out and helps customers integrate with some of their older legacy systems, their IT systems. And what we found when we started looking at the market, we found is that, you know, the funny thing about it is that people ask for the same information over and over and over again. And we were just going back to these older systems, pulling this data, same data sometimes, but we were pulling it back in some cases thousands and thousands of times a day. So if you think of a company that does maintenance on trucks or aircraft or whatever, they were pulling back part descriptions tens of thousands of times a day. The part descriptions were the same thing. The computer was always responding with the same data. So we said, what if we could take an idea that's fairly old in the computing world called caching, which lets us take that data and store it somewhere that's really easy to get to, and we can get to it really, really quickly without having to go bother those oftentimes overburdened legacy systems. What if we could stick that somewhere in memory and go get it really, really quickly the second time somebody asks for it in any subsequent iterations of that? So we built a new product. It's very, very easy to use. We took an old idea, put a new spin on it, and it has the potential to just dramatically increase the performance of some of these older systems because we're using new cloud-based technology, distributed systems, all that good stuff. But maybe more importantly, it also reduces the load on those older systems so that you don't have to just repeatedly ask them for the same information over and over again. They can spend their time doing useful work, and we can take the results there and get them back to the people that are asking for those results and that data much, much more rapidly than we could in the past.
So, I mean, in many ways, this is it's a consistent product with the overall sort of goals of Adaptogen that I know you've talked about before, this idea of extraction layers, not having to replace your systems, but allowing or supporting those systems in a way that allows them to do what they do good, and then using new technology to, this is a great example, to lighten the load, make it more efficient, allow it to do things that it couldn't do before because of innovations in technology. So I don't know what the word is. It's making it a leaner, meaner machine. Yes.
Yeah, absolutely. And and that's important to a lot of our customers. They want they know that they've got a lot of investment that they've made in these systems over the years, and they want to make sure that they're maximizing that investment. And sometimes moving to new technology from old technology can be not only very expensive and time consuming, but it can also be risky. Because a lot of our customers run these IT systems, the some of these older legacy systems, they run the business. They're things like core banking systems and core insurance systems. So they want to be able to leverage all the investments that they've made in the past, and at the same time kind of bring this stuff into the 21st century. So it turns out it's a neat place to be in. It's kind of the bridge between the past and the future, if you will, to use kind of a cheesy marketing term. But the fun thing is that we learned a lot from launching new products. Whenever you launch a new product, there's always this anticipation of, well, what are people going to think of this? And is this thing even going to fly in the marketplace? What's our competition doing? So on and so forth. So that's the tricky part to it, is that, you don't necessarily know when you launch a new product. And I think it's probably the same way with bands. Bands don't know. And I've read plenty of interviews with bands that were releasing new songs or new albums. And, in retrospect, they turned out to be big hits and they made a lot of money and sold a lot of records. But at the time, those bands didn't really know. They didn't know which ones were going to be the hits necessarily. They didn't know if the album was going to work. And sometimes they were completely wrong, both good and bad. So one of the tricky things when you launch a new product is actually building the product and trying to make sure that it's going to be something that works out in the market for you. So when I first suggested this idea for this new product a couple of years ago, people looked at me like I was from Mars. They were like, "Yeah, I don't really get it." You know what I mean? Like, there's always going to be some number of skeptics, and I think it's hard to know though. I was reading an interesting article with one of the guys in Rush. I think it was Geddy Lee, and he was talking about this idea that Rush doesn't have a back catalog of music that they never released. And the interviewer was like, "Why not?" And he said, "We were pretty good at figuring out if a song was just going to suck and when to just jettison it, so there's no like half stuff or whatever. They were really good at finding songs that just probably weren't going to make it and moving on to something else quickly rather than trying to record and re-record and rearrange and all that stuff. And I think that's true when you're launching new products as well, because you just don't know. And I think that's one of the lessons we learned along the way in building and launching this thing was, when do you persevere versus when do you give up? We were met with a lot of initial skepticism. It took a long time to get people to get on board with the idea. But now that we've done it and we've built it, it looks like it's going to be really good in the marketplace. And so figuring out that difference, figuring out knowing when to give up and when to persevere is one of the big lessons that we learned. And some people are really good at figuring out, wow, this is going to fly or this isn't going to fly. But one of the things we did was we spent a lot of time doing market research and market validation. So we went to our existing customers and we sat down with them and we took them through the idea and did a fair bit of market validation. And then as we were building it, we made sure that we kept in touch with those customers and we could float ideas by them and say, well, what if it did this? Or what if it did that? Or how would you guys use this sort of thing? So, this idea of market testing, market validation, it's an old idea in business, but it's something that I think a lot of times differs a lot from the music industry though, right? Like it's hard to market test a new album or figure, you know, like there's not the same level of rigor there, you know, and you know, keeping on the Rush theme, I also read an interview with them. And that's usually the job of the record company, right? The record company thinks they know what the market wants and they know what the fans are going to like. And sometimes they're right and sometimes they're very wrong. But, you know, Rush basically kicked the trend, though. They knew when to give up on bad songs, but they didn't listen to their record company at all back in the early days. You know, the record company came along and said, you know, we want you guys to be like Bad Company, but better. And they were like, no, that's not who we are, right? We're not Bad Company, but better or whatever, right? So the record company wanted them to do something. They went in completely the opposite direction. So in one sense, you know, they really did persevere. They stuck to their guns. They stuck to the core ideas that they had for music. But at the same time, they were really good at figuring out when a song wasn't going to work or when a concept really wasn't going to fly. And that's a very tricky calculus. You know, there's no simple rules for it, either in the music industry or in the business world. But one of the things we did find was the market validation not only helped us determine, you know, is there a market for this thing? But it also helped us actually design it. It helped us, you know, work through some of the questions that we had. And, you know, hindsight's 2020. It's always easy to look back and say, oh, well, of course that was going to be a hit, or of course that song was going to make it to number one. But at the time, you don't know. And it's a little bit scary when you do that.
So let's talk about the psychology there, because I think there's something in market validation. And this other piece that you said about sort of knowing when to stick with it and knowing when to bail. Because one of the things that I see, particularly, I mean, you all have been around for a long time, but particularly in smaller companies that have made some success, is, let's just call it, it's defensiveness, right? So it's, you don't want to hear the feedback that what you've got is not being embraced by the market, right? You haven't developed it yet. So it's not based on sales, but it's literally people saying what you have or what you're proposing, we don't think that there's a lot of interest in it. We're not that interested in it. And if you think about, you know, the passion that a lot of particularly founders or people, you know, running their own companies, that's hard to hear, you know, and in some ways, some people embrace it and go, okay, this is what it is. We're getting this feedback and we'll make a pivot. But I see just as many people, Alex, that's when they dig in and they say, it's defensiveness, but they call it something else. They're like, this is our passion. This is our mission. We're not going to let anything stop us. And we're going forward. And to use your rock analogy, you know, Rush is great because they're Rush and they already made it. There's a gazillion bands that stuck with their convictions and we've never heard of them. So what are your thoughts about that? Because I see the psychology and the sort of the emotional defense mechanisms there. And let's put it out there. It is hard to hear that your idea is not embraced by lots of people. What are your thoughts about that?
Well, yeah, because then you start second guessing yourself. You know, you're thinking, man, this is a great idea. And then people go, nah, it's not really a great idea, or I don't get it, or whatever. And so, you know, you get into that. You're right. You get into kind of a psychological trap there where you start second guessing yourself. You start second guessing the idea. And, you know, there's nothing wrong with that. You want to make sure that you try to come at it as objectively as possible. And, you know, the funny thing about inventors is that they're eternal optimists usually. When it comes to their inventions, right? They think it's going to change the world. They think it's going to be, and like, you know, you go back and look at things like the Segway, you know, that thing was the biggest flop maybe of all time in terms of product launches. Mm-hmm. And so many people threw so much money at that. I was reading an article that Steve Jobs from Apple just flat out said, we just want to buy this company, and offered hundreds of millions of dollars to buy the company. Cause even he got caught up in the hype and in the, you know, and it turned out to be, you know, yeah, it's cool for doing city tours and stuff. but I mean, it didn't revolutionize transportation. We're not all riding around on our Segways now. And in retrospect, it was easy to see that thing probably wasn't going to fly or be nearly as successful as people thought. But again, when you're in there and you're doing it, it's hard. And you're right. The psychology of it is interesting. because we have all these cognitive biases, right? We go out there and we have, you know, things like confirmation bias, right? Where I only seek out and want to listen to stuff that confirms what I'm already thinking. And you don't actively seek out dissenting opinions and whatnot. And
we don't see any of that now in politics, do we? Or
no, we never see that. No, but it's built into our cognitive makeup, right? And we've got selection bias. You know, you only select the things that are going to be appropriate for what you're doing. So there's all these cognitive biases when you're going in and looking at new products or new music or whatever it is. But I think the trick to overcoming those is to be aware of them. You know, most people aren't aware of the cognitive biases that we have. And when you're aware of them, you can at least do things to mitigate the effects. I don't think you can completely eliminate the effects, but I think you can do things to mitigate the effects. Like one of the things I like to do is when we're brainstorming or whatever, once we're done with that, the idea is to have a devil's advocate, you know, somebody in the room that's just going to, their whole job, whether they believe what they're saying or not, their whole job is to then poke holes in the whole thing so that you get a more balanced perspective, because, you know, energy and enthusiasm for new things can be contagious. And you want to make sure that you've got at least someone looking at it from the opposite viewpoint. Okay, tell me why you think this thing will fail, or what are the things we're not thinking about? So I find that's, you know, it's not perfect, but it at least gives you the ability to have a more objective viewpoint when you're coming up with ideas and you're trying to take them to market. It's very useful to have that kind of naysayer put in place intentionally when you're doing
it. But now you just laid something out that I think is really important. You are the president of this company. So it's one thing to say, look, as a team, we're going to poke holes in this thing and there's no wrong answers and there's no wrong bad ideas, blah, blah, blah. But I've seen time and again, you know, a leader in an organization is coming forth with an idea, or maybe they and their executive team are coming forth and they ask for feedback, or they'll even ask for, okay, let's poke holes in this sort of thing. And a lot of times the organization or the people underneath, I mean, they may poke a couple holes, but just because of the culture of the organization, they're real hesitant to, because they know that this is their pet project. I mean, how do you at Adaptogen, as the president, if you will, empower people to really shoot the thing down? Because I see a lot of situations where it's words and that's said, but it's not really embraced within the organization.
You got to build a culture to do it, right? And it's taken us a long time to build that kind of culture. For a lot of years, we kind of had this command and control, top-down hierarchical structure to the company. And, you know, people just weren't, they weren't very open about coming out with ideas and criticisms of ideas and being the naysayer or whatever. So I think it's important that you build it into the culture, and you have to, and what I find with culture building is that you have to reinforce it over and over and over again. You can't just say it, hey, you know, we've got a culture of openness and honesty and transparency. You have to repeat that a lot, and then you have to live it, and you have to live it even when it's difficult, even when there are topics that you'd rather not talk to the company about in an all hands meeting that you would rather avoid. You have to take them head on. And I think that's a big part of the culture, is not just saying it, not just having the right platitudes, but actually living it every day and encouraging people. So every time we talk about a new initiative or we talk about what's happening in the company, you know, there's always this call for questions, comments, feedback, but also, right. You know, come tell us if you think we're doing the wrong thing here, because we're not the only smart guy. The leadership team aren't the only smart people in the company. And all it takes is one person to be able to come forward and say, I don't think this is going to work for this reason that you all may not have thought of. And that can change the whole course of what you're doing, because again, you have all these cognitive biases, and if you don't get around those, and if you don't have a way of doing it, you can walk down this garden path, you know, like the old saying, the road to hell is paved with good intentions. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of truth to it, particularly in the corporate world. And I've seen products get launched and they just failed miserably. And in retrospect, you're looking back and going, what were these guys thinking? I mean, what could they have possibly been thinking when they launched this product? But you see how this culture of saying yes and getting behind something, it's tricky. It's hard to strike the right balance between people. So, you know, some people are just natural naysayers and they're gonna think every idea is dumb. And you don't necessarily want a whole bunch of those people, but you also do want, you want to have a healthy dose of skepticism in your organization and in your culture.
So I always say that you need to have three kinds of people or groups of people. You need to have your yes people because they make you just feel good. And then you need to have sort of your no people who are just going to shoot everything down all the time because that bookends it. But then you need to have the people that you see are going to go both ways. They're going to go in between. They're going to tell you yes when it's yes. They're going to tell you no when it's no. And I'd say the reason you kind of need all three is it creates more of an anchor and it creates more of a reality check. Because if you can see the absurdity of it, of the yeses or the nos, it's easier to see the sort of the reality of the middle. But what you're talking about, particularly with product development, I mean, I know we're talking about culture, but, and you talked about reinforcing, but it has to be reinforced like literally on a daily basis, because unless you don't have a hierarchy in your organization, if you're a solo person, or, you know, I guess if you're two equal partners, just by the nature of how we work in an organization, we're going to be hesitant to call into question leadership. I mean, literally, is this something at Adaptogen or other organizations you've worked with where you see that sort of openness every single day? And let me say this, without being so open that you can't get work done.
Well, that's true. Yeah, there's a fine line you have to walk. But I think you're right. I mean, it's an everyday thing. It's not just a once a week or once a quarter kind of discussion that you have with people, and people have to feel comfortable coming out and being a naysayer against something. And if they're not comfortable, if they fear any kind of retribution or that they're going to be looked down upon by the leadership team, then you get into a culture of fear, and a culture of fear is the last thing you want. But so many of our organizational models, you know, they come from the military, right? Where you're not supposed to question orders. It comes from the general right. to the colonel to the whatever, right? And you're just supposed to follow orders. And, you know, that just doesn't work well in innovative organizations. In fact, it's antithetical to what most organizations are really trying to do from an innovation perspective. And if you don't have the people that are coming up with the brilliant new ideas, but also have the people that are going to try to shoot some holes in them and make sure that you're really on the right track, if you don't have that balance within your company, you get yourself into a lot of trouble. And again, the Segway example, there's thousands of examples throughout history of products that were hyped up that were going to be the next big thing, and they turned out to be a disaster. And it wasn't that the people that came up with these ideas were stupid. Like the guy that came up with the Segway, I think his name was Dean Kamen. I mean, he's a brilliant guy. He right. had a long track record of some amazing innovations in the medical industry. And so it's not like the guy was stupid. It's not like the guy was just completely unaware of anything. Very, very smart person. But you start drinking your own Kool-Aid too much and you can end up in a position where you end up with a complete flop. So you're right. It's got to be something that you reinforce, this idea of bringing new ideas to the table. That's really important, too, because some people won't bring good ideas to the table because they think that, oh, well, this is not a good idea, or I couldn't possibly have come up with a great idea. And good ideas can come from anywhere within your organization. And I tell the people at Adaptogen, I tell everybody that works there all the time, it doesn't matter if you're an intern or you're the president of the company, a great idea, the spark for a great idea can come from anyone in the company. The trick is being able to share those ideas and having people feel like they can share them in the right kind of forum. And then also have the people that can tell you when it's a bad idea.
All right, let me pivot you just a little bit because I was just thinking about this in the time we have left. So there's good ideas and bad ideas and okay ideas and brilliant ideas and all that. But those are just ideas, right? So those are just things we're batting around and we're brainstorming. But you know, you were talking about a product launch. And then there's always that question, when are we ready to, is this ready to launch? Is it good enough? And I see it in every industry. I see it in relationships and parenting, the concept of the MVP and being okay with the MVP, but also having enough criteria around an MVP that it puts you on a road for success and not failure. Talk about that, because my goodness, you know, a viable product, I mean, people, that scares people to death once they have to go out and show it to people.
Yeah, particularly the sales guys, they hate it when you come out with a minimum viable product. They're like, no, we need all the features day one in order to be able to sell this thing. And you know, there's the old saying in sales that look, you don't get to sell what you wish you had. You get to sell what you have, what's on the truck right now, not what you wish was on the truck.
That happens in sales all the time. You sell what you wish you had in the truck, and then you come back and tell the people who are producing it, I just sold this, so we need to produce it.
Yeah, that happens too, and that's even more dangerous.
My experience has been the latter far more than what you just said. It's always that way. It's like, wait, you sold what?
We don't actually
close the contract on what? We can't do that. But you're gonna have to, because we just saw. I'm sorry. All right, go ahead.
You're right. It happens all the time. They're flip sides of the same coin. On one hand, you have people that, oh, if I had this feature, I could have sold it to this company. And then you have the people that just say, you know what, we'll figure it out. We'll tell them it does it or whatever. But yeah, it's a tricky balance. But one of the things we learned is, you know, you don't have to have every single feature that you want to have in a product in order to be able to launch the product. You've got to get to that point where you say, this is going to be useful and valuable to, you know, whatever percentage of the market, 50% or 70%. And so you've got to prioritize your development. And then you've also got to figure out, at what point are we going to launch this thing? But one of the things we learned was, you know, don't wait for everything to be perfect, for every feature that you want to have in the product to be available. Go ahead and get it out there in the market. And the cool thing that happens there is that there are features that are on your roadmap that may not actually matter to people once they start using it. They might say, oh, actually, I don't need a feature like that. And then they'll also come back to you with features and capabilities that you never thought of. So being able to get things out into the marketplace that are, you know, and again, not looking at it from a quality perspective, you always want to produce high quality products and services. You always want to make sure that what you're delivering is going to work. It's going to work at scale. So it's really prioritizing all the things you wish you could do with what does the market need right now. And then you get out into the market and it becomes this organic process of developing requirements and listening to the way people are using your products. And again, they may be using them in ways that you had never anticipated. So I think it's a good idea to get things out maybe sooner rather than later. Don't wait for every single feature to be done. Get it out there in a marketplace and then listen really carefully. Listen to what your early adopter customers are telling you, because chances are, if you hear something a few times from a few different data points, you can kind of triangulate that into, okay, this is probably what the market wants. Now you can get misled, but in general, we found that to be a much more effective strategy than trying to dream up every feature that we thought would be a good idea without getting it out there in the marketplace and getting some real world feedback on it.
Man, what you just said is so insightful, so far beyond business, because you said something that was really important, and you said a minimal viable product. It's not all about having all the features and functions, but it's also not about putting something out there that is not of high quality, right? So it may be simpler, it may have less complexity to it, or it may have less functions, but what you have out there is good. And if you think about it, versus just having ideas and never getting it out there, right? So if you think about, I was just thinking about, if you think about relationships, you think about parenting, think about any of that kind of stuff, you know, I want to be the perfect spouse. I want to be the perfect parent. I want to be the perfect everything. Well, those are your ideas. And if you never kind of get it out there, you never get a chance to try. But at the same time, if you try to be the fully comprehensive product, again, be it partner, friend, parent, you'll probably fall flat on your face. B, it's what you said is, you know, your partner may be like, hey, that's great that you can do all that, but I really don't need these qualities. And so this ability to put some things out there to test, and what you put out there is really good. And it's not that it's crappy that what you're putting out there, but it's you're evolving your product, whether that product is technology or you, by the feedback that you're getting from the marketplace, or in this case, people around you. I mean, is that consistent with the way you're thinking?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And the analogy we use in the software industry, or I guess in a lot of industries, is that, you know, you can make a really, really nice cupcake that's beautiful. It's baked perfectly. It's got all the nice frosting on it. It's decorated well. But what you don't want to try to do is produce a big crappy cake, right? You know, you want to focus your efforts, right? So you want to, you know, when you're trying to launch an MVP, you want to go for a cupcake that's really good and does exactly what you say it does. And it does it well with the right level of quality, the right level of performance, whatever the characteristics are people are looking for. But don't try to go out and do the whole thing and do a crappy job at every single aspect of it. And I think that's true again with products, or it's true with relationships. You know, start small, build a foundation, build a high quality foundation, and then you can build upon that. But if you try to, you know, and it's even when you're trying to change your own habits or anything else, mm-hmm. they tell you, don't try to tackle every bad habit you have all at once. Focus on one of them, try to change that habit, and then move on to the next one. So yeah, I think it's applicable across a lot of different domains.
So you're also telling me, be okay with an album that just has, you know, maybe one or two songs that are just going to be a hit, but the album overall is pretty good, and you'll evolve the compilation of them over time.
Well, yeah. And if you look at a lot of bands, I mean, at least, you know, going back to your earlier point about there's a whole bunch of bands we've never heard of. I mean, you know, I think when you look at bands, producing those one or two hits on every album was a critical success factor to a lot of bands in their history. You know, there are bands that produced a lot of very high quality songs, but none of them were ever hits. And so they never got the airplay. They never got the mind share of people. As opposed to having one or two big hits on an album that people rallied around and became big fans. And then they listen to the rest of your stuff and they go, oh, it's pretty good too. And in some ways it's better maybe than the hits because it's more musically rich or the lyrics are better, but just isn't going to get the same kind of popularity. So yeah, I think you can see analogies to this in personal life, in the music world, in the business world. But whatever you do, try to do it as well as you possibly can. And if you have to cut the scope down, if you have to focus your efforts on doing one or two things really, really well, focus on those rather than trying to get every possible thing crammed into a new release of a product.
Well, let me do this. Let me congratulate you on the product launch, you and Adaptogen. That is all the time we have for this episode of Adaptive Pairs. But if you stay tuned to Tony Curry Radio, you're going to get yet another amazing episode of Adapt or Perish.
This has been a special presentation of Tony Curry Radio.